Hello, this is Leroy Chatfield, the director of the Farm Worker Movement Documentation Project. Today is Wednesday, March the 4th, 2009. This interview is another in a series dedicated to Cesar Chavez and his farm worker movement, 1962 to 1993. Today's interview guest is Abby Flores Rivera, a librarian from Fresno County, California, who grew up in a migrant worker family and became a longtime volunteer with the farm worker movement. This interview will be published on the website www.farmworkermovement.us and may be found in the oral history section in the chapter entitled Growing Up in a Migrant Worker Family. Welcome to the interview, Abby. And let me start by asking you to give us your name and tell the listening audience something about who you are, where you live, and what you do.
Okay, my name is Obdulia Flores Rivera, and actually Abby is my nickname, and most of the world knows me by Abby. I live in a city that's south of Fresno, Kingsburg. And I have been living here since 1995, but I did grow up here in the San Joaquin Valley, although I was born in Texas. And I work for the Fresno County Public Library, and I work in the Literacy Services Center, where I'm the coordinator for Families for Literacy. And the work that I do is work with adult learners, helping them prepare their children to get ready for kindergarten. So I teach them reading strategies. And it's a very rewarding thing that I do, and I like it when I see the children. I only meet with them quarterly. The parents, I meet with them more often. So it's nice to see the children and all the good work that the parents are doing with them.
Good. Thank you.
That's what I do.
Now, my next question is, how old were you, and when, and under what circumstances do you remember first meeting Cesar Chavez, and what were your first impressions?
I first met Cesar in 1966. That's when I personally spoke to him and shook his hand, and I was 15 years old. I had seen him many times before, but that's the one day that I got to speak to him. We were out at the Quonset Hut. We had had lunch. We had come back from picketing all morning out in the fields. We had lunch and got together afterward in a little area where he met with all of us and gave us an update for the day. Afterward, my father went to meet with him or speak to him, and my sister and I followed him a little later to wait for him, and Cesar saw us, and he was surprised. He said, "I thought you were students. These are your daughters." And my father said yes, and he introduced us, and we shook hands. Students had come out before from the city, so he thought that we were students that were visiting instead of farm worker children. My impression of Cesar, before I ever met him, I saw him, and I was very, very impressed because he just looked like one of us. He was wearing khaki pants, a plaid shirt, working boots. He had a very soft way of, about him, like when he spoke and the way he spoke. It was very natural and very sincere, and his language was also very sincere, and he just spoke to us, and it seemed like he just got every message across to us. And my impression was that he was somebody that really cared, that he was someone who really understood us, and that he had actually walked the same path we had. So he was getting across to me, because the things that he spoke of were things that I had wondered about and had also you know, heard my dad speak of things like, you know, wanting things to be better for us out in the fields. And that really impressed me because I never really thought that other people, we were like in our own little family group, and I never thought that this was something that a lot of people were thinking of. But here was a man who was bringing it all together, was speaking about it, and really making a lot of sense.
Good. Okay. Now, let's start the conversation about your family. You say that you came from Texas. Could you begin there?
Yes, we came from Texas, and we moved to Hollister. And I must have been about 6 years old, which would have been like about 1955. And we moved to Hollister. And that's, Hollister is, I guess you would call it the Central Coast area. And, it's before you get to, Gilroy, and then later on you can travel up 152 to get to San Jose. In any case, we went there to live with my brother. And we lived with him, and I finished school that year. And that summer, I started working in the fruit trees. And that was my first really experience working in the fields. My dad had been a migrant, but I had never worked in the fields.
Okay. Now, when you moved from Texas to Hollister, how many were in the family at that point?
At that point, we moved with my brother, and there were 10 of us, including my parents, but my older brother was living there. I had an older brother that had been there, but he left to go down to San Diego, where it turned out that the work was even cheaper there. The wages were so cheap there that he came back and settled in Woodville. But there were 10 of us, including my parents.
10? You had 7 brothers and sisters?
Well, what happened is there are 14 in my family.
Oh, okay.
But, yes, but my brother was married. My two sisters stayed back in Texas. One was going to school. Both of them were living with my grandmother. And my brother, Noe, is the one that traveled south. So there were 10 of us left, including my parents, or 8 children, and plus my stepmother and my father. I guess if you look at my family, I'm the 9th one from the top, or 6th from the bottom up, whichever way you want to look at it. But
what were your parents?
We are a large family.
What were the names of your parents?
My father's name was Luis Perez Flores. My mother's name was Maria Garza Flores, but she passed away when I was 2 years old. My dad remarried, and my stepmother's name was Rosa Rivera.
Okay.
No relation to the Rivera that I married.
Okay. And the names of your brothers and sisters, in order, if you can remember them?
Oh, of course I can remember. I love my brothers and sisters. From the top down, Felipe, Beatriz, Noe, Arcelia, Saul, Enoch, Ines, Alma, me, Horatio, Luis, Isaac, Yolanda, and Ephraim.
Good. Now, at what age did you start working, do you remember, in the fields? And what kind of work did you do?
As I stated before, I believe I was around 6, and I started working in the fruit trees. We picked pears, apricots, cherries. I think that's peaches later on, but we worked for Sanger Brothers in Hollister, and at one point too, when we worked with them, we also worked in what is called La Tabla, which is cutting apricots and pitting them and laying them on trays so that they can be, they put them in dehydrators to make the dried fruit. So I worked in that. And that was my experience at that time. And
did
in the prunes. We worked in the prunes, too, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Did you work all day?
we started early in the morning, and whenever it ended at the end of the day, I guess by 4 o'clock, yes, I did. I was very little, so there was really no pressure for me to do a lot of work, but I was tiny, and that kind of helped because I could scramble around and pick the prunes, and even though I was short, I could still reach and get the bottom fruit from the bottom of the trees, and then I did a lot of running around, getting buckets, moving buckets, that sort of thing, bringing boxes, and I felt very good about being able to do that. I felt like I was contributing.
Uh-huh. Were your family members paid the piece rate?
Sometimes we were paid piece rate because they paid you by the tree or by the bucket, the bin. I know, like with pears, we were paid 5 cents a bucket, but it took about 20 buckets. Took about 20 buckets to fill the bin. It's really funny because I think I read somewhere where Caesar made a comment that he figured out how much money all his family had made per hour, and he said that they were making 19 cents an hour. Well, if you figure, in my family, with $12 a day, that's like 5 cents a bucket, 2 buckets per box, 40 boxes per bin, that would be we made about 3 or 4 bins per day, that would be like $12 a day. But if you divided it among the 6 of us who would have been normally working, that would be like $2 a day, which would then be 20 cents an hour.
Mm-hmm.
That's not very much,
No.
But, $12 a day, one person working wouldn't have been able to make $12 a day. So it's a little bit of a little something. And
right.
We were very little, because my brothers, my sister above me is 1 year older than me. Then I have a brother 3 years older than me, and then one that's 4 years older than me. So our ages were very young still,
Now, you worked all summer, huh?
We worked all summer during different crops, different things that we did, but yes, all summer. That was in Hollister. Then we moved to San Jose, where we worked for a grower named J.W. Fair. And oddly enough, the contractor was one of our church members. And I have to say, he was a nice man. And sometimes I think about contractors, and not all of them are good, but not all of them are bad either. But I think that we just lived in a time period where we accepted so many things the way they were. We accepted the fact that we had no drinking water, or that we would all share a little bucket of water and a ladle, that we had no bathrooms. We never said anything, and I don't know. I think about it sometimes, and I wonder, why didn't we do something? Why didn't we say something? And it's just, I've spoken to this about it with my family, and one of my brothers said it's just like the conditioning that we had. Way back even in my dad's time when he was a migrant, it was unheard of for us to ask for anything, and we better not, or we'd get fired. And so I think it was our mindset. We had been conditioned to think that way.
Mm-hmm.
But to think that so many of us out there working, not one bathroom for all of us, how disgusting. I think about it sometimes, and I think, can you imagine those fields? Everybody had to go dig a little hole. And it wasn't very sanitary. It was very humiliating. And a lot of people got sick because they didn't want to go out and do anything, and it was very unhealthy for them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they wind up having health issues later.
Mm-hmm.
And then with the water, I know that I was really disgusted one time because in my home, my parents were very strict. We couldn't share utensils. We weren't allowed to share anything. We had, any of our eating utensils and our cups, and we had to cover our mouths when we sneezed and wash our hands. And my parents were real careful to teach us that. And we go out into the fields, and everybody's drinking out of a ladle. Oh, it was really disgusting. So my dad would bring bring containers of water for us so that we wouldn't have to share drinking water. Mm-hmm. But to think that we were conditioned that way and we just accepted it, I don't know what to say, but it did take getting past that to say, you know, that should be provided for us. I mean, who in America goes to work at a factory or at an office and not have a place to drink water and to use the bathroom? I mean, it's so basic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just, you know, that's just for starters, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But,
Where were you living in Hollister, and could you describe your living conditions when you were at that age and you were working with your family in the field?
We lived in with my brother for a short spell, but then and that was pretty crowded as it was because he had company housing. And then we moved to a little tiny house, and I guess it were like four or five little houses. You can still see them if you're traveling. Before you get to Pacheco Pass, if you're heading towards San Jose or Gilroy, they're on your right-hand side, and there are four little houses. They had outhouses in the back, and there was a communal shower. So we would go out and work in the fields, and everybody would line up to take showers after work. But the house where we lived had a little one room as you enter, which was our living room, bedroom, everything room. And to the back was our little kitchen area with a sink and a stove and running water, and not for bathing, just for cooking. And that was in San Jose. I mean, excuse me, that was in Hollister, where we worked for the Sangers, and that was their company housing. Then we moved to San Jose, and we lived behind a church in a little shack, actually, that belonged to the church. And we had thought that we would move somewhere later, but we never did. We lived there, I guess, close to a year and a half before we moved. And my parents slept in a separate area in another little room attached to another building. And then we went inside the church to use their bathroom and their bathtub. But we cooked on a kerosene stove, and we washed dishes in a pan and threw it out in the yard. And we washed outside, dumped all our water from our hand-washed clothing out in the dirt. Then we moved to, having lived there in San Jose, we moved to Rich Grove, which is 10 miles east of Delano. And we lived in a little trailer at first in the property where my stepmother's family lived. And it was a small little living room area where we just kind of slept side by side like little sardines from one side of the wall to the other. And my parents slept in the back little bedroom with the two small babies. After that, we moved to, we must have lived there for past the winter that year. I can only go by my grade. I was in the fourth grade when we moved there, which may have been like 1959. By the following, after winter, we moved, or right around wintertime, we moved to a box car. And so I lived in that little box, to a box car.
What is a box car?
A box car is housing that was invented or constructed, where they literally took old box cars that were used at one point, freight cars, you know, box cars, and they crisscrossed them and attached them together. And it had as you entered, it had a small little kind of entry area, which could be used as a small little bedroom area, except that it had so many openings that it was pretty cold or pretty hot. But then you entered, and it was like a little living room area, and to the right was a bedroom, and to the left was another bedroom. And then as you continued toward the back, it was a kitchen area. And we had a little stove that was a butane stove, and we only had cold water, and then we had an outhouse. Then, because there were four of these boxcar homes in that little area where we lived, we had a communal shower that only had cold water. So, of course, we used that during the summer because it's extremely hot during the summer, and that's fine, but we couldn't use it during the winter. We would heat up our water. We had a little potbelly stove, and we would heat our water there and take baths inside the house. And we would burn vines, grapevines, because, you know, when winter's over, they have to prune everything. They just prune everything from the vineyards and just leave the main trunk and some of the shoots. You have to get rid of everything for the next crop.
So you would burn that in your potbelly stove, huh?
Yes, and that's how we would heat our home.
Uh-huh.
Because it was cheaper, of course, than using our butane, and that might not have been very good to do anyway. It's kind of dangerous, but we lived there until I was in the eighth grade when we moved to another house there in town in Richgrove, because that's where we were living at the time. And that house had it was a nicer home, more expensive, which, by the way, we had to pay for that boxcar. We're paying like about $35 and it went to $40 a month. And here it is with a family that, you know, my dad was earning even less when we first moved there, but it was maybe under $1 an hour working mm-hmm. all day. So that's a big percentage of your money going toward rent. So anyway, we moved to the other house, and it was owned by one of the people that owned a grocery store there in town, and it had a big living room, dining room, kitchen, two bedrooms, and then a washroom in the back. The back washroom, my sister and I converted it into a bedroom, and that was our bedroom. So the boys slept in one room, my parents in the other, and my sister and I.
How many were living in this particular house, this better house?
There were ten of us.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'm wondering, because when we were in San Jose, there might have been 11 of us. I'm just remembering my brother Saul was living with us, and he stayed behind in San Jose. He lived in a garage, went to work, stayed over there, and would send money to my dad and continued living there. So actually, there were 11 of us at that point. And when we mm-hmm. moved to Richgrove, there were 10 of us. So there were 10 of us all the way up until my oldest brother was drafted into the service, which would have been like about 1965. And my other brother left to go to the Army also, and maybe like about 2 years later. Mm-hmm. But
When you were living in Richgrove, did you continue to work in the fields yourself?
We always worked, every year. Every year we worked, and during the winter too, when we could get out there on weekends. But my dad, there was a time when there was work available, because there are periods in the winter when there is no work. And so when there was work available, then my dad would go to work. And winters were very, very difficult, because there is very little work. And my dad was the type of person that did not want to accept any kind of aid, you know, welfare, any kind of money. And even my brother told him that we qualified, and he said, no, I don't want to do that. And because we had just moved and things were very, very hard, and it was hard adjusting and finding where to work and that sort of thing, that first year was really rough, the second year too. And my dad accepted food commodities that I guess the agriculture department puts out. And we were really happy about that. But he never accepted money. And, he just felt that if he could, that he would try to find work. And he was always looking.
What kind of work did he do? What kind of work did you do?
It's the whole family working, first of all. I had my brother Noe that came back and lived in Woodville, so we would go to stay with him as soon as school was out, and we would pick prunes. Excuse me, we would chop cotton. And I guess the grower, there were various growers that we worked for. One of them was Vossler. Then there was Falco, and then there was John Costa. Some of them were cotton growers. Some of them were fruit tree growers. So depending on what we were doing at the time. We started off with chopping cotton, and what that entailed was thinning the rows of cotton because you don't want the plants to get too crowded. And I know that a few times I went out there and we were chopping cotton, that we were actually like weeding the cotton. I don't know if they hadn't sprayed or why we were doing that, but I remember doing that. Then we moved on to picking prunes.
Well, and let's talk about Abby, let's talk about chopping cotton. What does that entail? Tell us how people chop cotton.
Well, you use a long hoe. Now, whether they did a short hoe, I don't know. But by the time I was doing it, I don't think we ever used a short hoe. But it's a long hoe, and you just, I don't know, spaces. You have to remove the whole plant so that it'll allow one of the plants to grow bigger and they won't get crowded. But it also helps to get the right, well, that's how I understand it, that you don't want the plant to be so crowded that it impedes its growth. You know, mm-hmm. it'll,
that's now, were these are all in like furrowed rows, is that right?
Yeah, long rows. We were paid by the hour. I don't know if there are people that were paid by the row. I don't know, but we were paid by the hour.
Do you remember how much you were paid? Do you remember how much you were paid?
I believe we were paid $1 an hour, maybe a little less, because I know that when the union came, things changed, and we were all excited because we were getting paid $1.10 an hour. Mm-hmm. But my dad would work, me, my sister, and my brothers were working somewhere else. So my dad usually had my sister and I with him, and maybe one of my brother that was older than my sister, Enos. But the rest of us, I mean, my other brothers were working other places,
uh-huh.
you know, or at any given time. So anyway, that's what we would do. Then later on, because my Woodville is, by the way, you should probably know, it's by Porterville, and it's from where I lived in Rich Grove. It would be like about 40 minutes away. So we would have to come and stay with my brother in Woodville so that we could go to work in the fields. And unless my dad brought us, which he did at the very beginning, he would bring us to the fields every day, and we would go home every day. But later, he got a more steady job, so we were able to come on our own, stay with my brother and my sister-in-law, and go and work in the fields. Now, my dad was working in Delano, where we did the grapes. I know that at some point we worked for Shinley, and we worked in the gondola. We worked for other growers where we just did table grapes, I don't remember packing grapes, so I don't know if other people were packing them, but I know that we did table grapes. Then my other brothers had gotten older, so many of them became tractor drivers. I know my brother Noe from Woodville had steady employment for years working as a tractor driver, as a swamper. So swamping means lifting the picked grapes that are in stacks at the end of the rows in the fields and putting them on trucks. And he had a buddy that he would work with, and they would lift the grapes onto the truck, and they were paid like $1.25 per box. So he would make good money. He would be making like about $50 a day. But that's a swamper, and that takes a toll on your body. So much so
how heavy are those boxes?
Oh my gosh. You know what? I would have to say they were 30 pounds?
25,
maybe? Maybe 20,
25
to 30? I could be wrong.
Were they table grapes or lugs?
They were lugs of grapes.
Oh, then so they had to be close. Then they had to be 40 pounds, didn't they?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking about, more like 40. So what they would do is he and his buddy would work. One would lift from the ground to the truck, and then they would stack them. And they did that all day, Then during the winter, he would prune, and then my little brother, Horatio, would come out, would take the bike out there where they were working, if he, they were nearby, which they usually were, or wherever he, they were working, and he would help them remove all the branches from under the trees and put them in the center row so they could get more pruning done, because they were paid by the tree. Mm-hmm. So then my other brother, Enoch, was working somewhere else, and he was working as a truck driver, which they made a little bit more money. All of us, by the way, worked out in the fields. I mean, all the, you know, fruit crops, peaches, pears, apricots, cherries, prunes, which are plums, and then working out, you know, in the tablas, which I said earlier is cutting the apricots, cutting them in half, taking out the pit, having them dried. Then we worked chopping cotton, picking cotton. We worked in the potatoes. We worked in the onions. We worked in the peas. We worked. I mean, all these different. So it wasn't just you know, we were like, whatever work was available, that's where we worked. And we were mostly, we didn't even know what growers we were working for half the time, because it was contractors, and people would just come and, hey, they're starting the pisca for this. The pisca is the picking. They're starting the pisca for that tomorrow, and then you work, and they're starting the pisca. And they're in Rich Grove, you know, the voice would carry, and we would all be ready. And so as we got older, after having all these little different jobs, different works here and there, my brothers kind of settled into doing truck driving. My brother Enoch worked for Keratin. He worked for Pavage. He worked for Carrick. And at the end, he was working for Keratin before he got drafted. And he did everything from tractor driving, swamping, a rig sprayer, where he would spray sulfur on the grapes, and then at the end, before he was drafted, he was working as a forklift driver, loading grapes into the railway cars, and he was making good money, actually, because he would get a penny a box, and he was able to load 1,500 boxes into those railroad box cars, and he would do like about three of them a day, which means he would come out like, what, $45 or something. But, you know, that was after having done all this other work, and, you know, it was a lot of money compared to $10 or $8 a day or $9 a day, you know.
Mm-hmm. You picked potatoes?
I did, but...
Can you tell us how that works? How do you pick potatoes?
All I know is I just got them and put them in a bag. I have no idea. Other than that, I was very, very little, and I only picked them once. All the other times I picked potatoes was actually, after that experience, my brothers picked them more. What I had to do a lot of the times, because I was so little and I couldn't lift things, I would have a little container or something that I would drag along, then I would go and put it in somebody else's container, because I couldn't carry too much.
What about picking cotton?
Cotton, the same thing. The only thing I remember about picking cotton is that I got scratched in my hands a lot. And we had to take the little cotton out of the little balls. And then I remember my first experience, because I had never picked cotton before, is seeing this long tube, which is our canvas bag. And it's really long. And I remember going to put a little few pieces of cotton in there. And I thought, oh my gosh, how am I ever going to fill this bag up? Because it was so wide and it was so little and my hands were so tiny. So I was pick, put them in a little bag, and run over there and dump them. Pick, run over to the bag and dump them. You know, so I was very little. But that's hard work. One thing I never understood, because I thought, I enjoyed picking cotton. Actually, I like cotton. And I thought, how come we're not going out there? And I never knew. I just went wherever my dad took me. And it wasn't until later that I discovered that it had become mechanized. And really, nobody was picking cotton. And that really surprised me because I didn't even know when that happened. There was no discussion in my family. But it really eliminated a lot of jobs.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Mm-hmm. The same thing with prunes. One day I go, how come nobody picks prunes? You know, what's going on? Well, my brother was telling me that he was out there driving the truck now where they put a canvas underneath one side of the tree. Another guy on the other side with a canvas, like a little V shape, they shake the tree. All these prunes fall into the canvas, and then they kind of go into a machine that kind of collects them. No more farm workers picking prunes. And I thought, oh my gosh, that's a lot of people out of work. I didn't even know that. That was my brother, Horatio, by the way, worked many different jobs. I know that at one point he worked, well, with all the places that I worked, he worked, of course, but he did work with Superior Farms and did a lot of work with him, truck driving and machine operator. But at one point, he worked for this one grower named Thomas, where he picked, where he drove a big combine for the wheat. And he worked the whole summer. At first, you know, he wanted to get paid and, you know, what's the deal here with getting paid. And he thought he would get paid in a timely manner. And the contractor told him, well, no, at the end of the season, you'll get paid. So he worked his little heart out. He worked he worked 16-hour days, not just 8 or 9. There were 16-hour days. At the end of the season, when he went to collect with the grower, Thomas, he said, no, I paid the contractor. You need to go to him. So there goes my brother. And you know who the contractor was? It's Frank Herrera. Bad contractor. Mm-hmm. He later became the mayor of Delano.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. So there goes my brother. He goes, no, Thomas is supposed to pay you. There goes my brother back. No. And he was like, kind of like, what? No, I paid Frank. Went back to Frank. No, no, I don't have the money. You know, that back and forth. And they did not pay him. He worked his little heart out, you know, 18, 19 years old.
And never got paid.
Never got paid. When he told my brother about it later, he was so angry. Never got paid. But, you know, that's one thing that was really frustrating. Actually, I prefer to work picking peas and they pay us right away. Or working somewhere and they pay us right away. Because otherwise, you never knew when you were going to get paid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some growers were better than others, but it was like you were always chasing down your payroll check. You would go here, you would go there. Then you go here, they'd send you over there. You go there, they'd send you over here. What is that? I mean, you worked your heart out. You did what you were supposed to do. You did everything right. Let alone, I mean, working cheap. But then you didn't get paid. Well, I know for a fact, I get a statement from the Social Security. I was working very, very young. I even got my Social Security when I was 13. Do you think that I have anything listed on there? I don't. Not until I went to work in L.A. when I was 20 do I show any kind of income. Same thing with my brothers. My brother Enoch that worked doing all this different work, he says that he only showed in his statement that he had like about 300-something income dollars, 1961, in his statement. My brother Enoch the same. My brother Noe the same. They worked like all these years, and there's nothing there for their Social Security. My brother Noe was really ahead of his time because he said, you know what, I'm 30 years old. You know, how long can my body take swamping? You know, doing this kind of physical work. Plus, my family needs medical help, I mean, a medical plan, something to help us if we get sick, if we need to go to the doctor. So he went to the employment office and he told them that he wanted a job. You know, he came right out of the field. He was wearing his work clothes. And the guy said, well, there's not really anything. And he goes, well, he went to EDD, which is the Economic Development Department. I guess it's the Employment Department. And he asked them for work. He says, well, I don't think we have anything right now. He goes, well, maybe there's a little bit of oranges. Somebody needs help there with the oranges. He goes, look, I don't need you, your help, to tell me where to go find work in the fields. That's not why I'm here. If I want to work in sales, I can find that work myself. I'm here because I want to work somewhere else, in a factory, some kind of industry. And then they go, well, you know, for that kind of job, you know, you have to take a test. Oh, yeah? Well, I have taken so many tests here. You want me to take another one? How many more tests are you going to give me? And here was my brother who missed by a few months having to go to fight in Korea, who had been in the Air Force, was a vet. He couldn't get a job. So the guy went and pulled out his files. He said, oh, yeah, you have taken these tests, which I'm sure he did really, really good, because they never called him. And he said, you're a vet? He goes, yes, I am. So they sent him right away to go to an interview to Jostens, the new company in town. And even Jostens was afraid to hire him. So here you're making $50 a day, and we're only paying $1.65 an hour. Will you be happy here? Well, he said, yes, I will, because you offer benefits. You offer family medical benefits, which I want, and you have a retirement plan, which is what I'm looking for. And also, there's job security. You know, I can get old and work in this company. They hired him. And, you know, we're all good workers, you know. Very faithful, you know, doing a good work and stuff. And he moved on until at one point, at the end, before the company did move back east, he was a supervisor. He retired as a supervisor, and right now he has retirement pay. He was always able to provide health care for his family. And see, I love that story because he saw that. You know, a lot of people saw that. You know, what could we do? My brother said, you know, I was fortunate that I got that job because those kind of jobs went to white people. They never gave us a chance. You know, in our area where we lived, they did not give us a chance for those jobs. So he said, I was fortunate in that company came here and really did not know what it was like here, that there was that type of discrimination. They came here very open-minded, very good company, and they allowed us all to apply, you know, which cannot be said the same for other companies in the Valley, where it was just kind of an understood thing, you know, this is who you hire, and these are the people you don't hire, you know.
Uh-huh.
Well, that wasn't giving us much of a chance, you know.
Right. Abby, let me change the subject a little bit. How did you get an education? Because you now have a very responsible job in a library. How did you get the education to be able to do that?
Well, thanks to my father, who believes strongly in education. When we were working out in the fields, we worked hard, but he didn't want us to work in the fields when it was school time. So he never kept us, you know, past starting day of the first day of school. First day of school, we were there. If any of us acted up in school, well, we were not only going to have to deal with a discipline from the school, we're going to have to accept the discipline that he was going to give us.
Mm-hmm.
He believed in education. He thought that whatever work we want to do in life, that's fine. If you want to be a farm worker, wherever you want to work, but you're going to have, you're going to choose what you want to do. You know, there's dignity in whatever you do. So, but at least know how to read and write and be a critical thinker. So I guess that's what it was. He wanted us to do good, and he knew that education would provide whatever it was. And it did, because it helped. The fact that I went to school and did learn to read and write, and I was able to take tests that might be difficult for other people that cannot read or write. And I was able to do well in those. And in any case, what I did is, during the summer, we always worked to save money for school, for our clothes, for everything. Hard work is not foreign to us. So what I did, by the time I graduated from high school, I took my SAT test because my dad had allowed us to have a good education. I did well. I applied to a junior college. As soon as I started going to junior college, I applied to work in their work studies program. So I was able to pay for my books and my tuition. And then halfway through my high school year, to backtrack a little, I had gotten a job through Proteus, which is an organization that trains you to do different jobs, and they trained me to do bookkeeping. So I had that job, and that started like a few years after the strike started, the Delano grape strike. I started earning that money, and it was like $80 a month. That is what helped supplement my family. I would buy meat and vegetables. And so in 1968, when I started junior college, it also helped me with little whatever other things I needed. So I was working work studies and receiving that other money from my Proteus job training. And I did the bookkeeping for the adult night class. That's what I did in my community of Richgrove. So I finished my 2 years. My sister went to school also, work studies, and afterwards she went to work and then got married and moved to L.A. and went to Northridge and got a student loan there. I worked 2 years, came to work for the Farm Workers Credit Union. Then in 1970, well, I worked all along in the credit union from 1966 to 1970. Then anyway, I went to work in L.A. and went to night school, worked full part-time, went to school part-time. Then I could not get a student loan. I wanted to go to finish my education. They would not give me a student loan because they wanted my dad's income tax return. He had never filed an income tax because there were so many of us, he didn't have to. They would not understand that or could not understand that. Finally, I went to visit a friend in Seattle, Washington, and I wanted to visit the organizations up there, the Chicano movement organizations, and they told me about school there in Washington, at the University of Washington. And that same day that I spoke to the EOP person, he got me financial aid. So I went to work. I moved to Washington and finished my last 2 years at the University of Washington. But because I have no source of income and that money was to pay for my tuition and living my tuition and books, I didn't have very much for living expenses. So I also applied at the university, and I got a job part-time, working 20 hours a week in the Latin American Studies Department, and then later on in the Chemistry Department as a secretary, called secretary then. Mm-hmm. And I saved my money. I would send some home to my dad, but I saved my money because if there was a family emergency, I would have to have money to get home because there was nobody taking care of me but me. And then I also saved money so that I could, when I had to move home, I would have money available to do that. And that's what I did. Helen Chavez called me, that's Cesar Chavez's wife. They were going to be closing the credit union, and she asked me to come back to help them because they were really, really desperate, and they needed to fix everything up. The credit union was falling apart. They had too many delinquencies on their loans. So I left school 9 units short. I was taking them, but I didn't finish them. So I left and I went to Delano, and not that I didn't have help, because I did, but I went door knocking, got all those people to start paying whatever little they could, and we cleaned up everything. And by October, when we had our audit, everything was fine, and everybody was pleased, and I was too. By then, we were in La Paz, And
what year was this then?
That would have been in 1975, exactly, 1975.
Okay.
And so then I stayed in La Paz until 1979 when I got married. I met my husband in La Paz. I was working in the accounting department, and he was Caesar's security guard, and then Caesar picked him to go into the Fred Ross Senior School of Negotiations. And before my husband passed away in 2005, he had become the chief negotiator. And the best teacher he ever had in the whole wide world was Caesar Chavez. Mm-hmm. He learned a lot from Dolores Huerta, the best negotiator you will ever know, along with right there, side by side with Caesar, and also Richard Chavez, the three people that he really admired. My husband was a good negotiator, and he understood, because he was a farm worker, he understood so much, and he taught me a lot, too, because I knew the words for things, but I didn't know the language. So, you know, he taught me a lot, too.
Well, when did you start work with Fresno County?
Now, first of all, I want to make a correction. I am not a librarian. I'm a senior library assistant. And okay. I started working with them in 1995 when I came back. When we were married, we moved down to San Ysidro and San Diego. And as the years went by, he left the union and became a machinist, then left that later and started working with Eliseo Medina with SEIU. He left there and came to work with SEIU in the Bay Area, and from there they transferred him to Fresno. So we moved here into town where I live in 1995. Mm-hmm. 3 years, Caesar passed away in a year or so after Caesar passed away, my husband was asked if he would come and work for the union, for the United Farm Workers, and he did. So he worked with the United Farm Workers shortly after Caesar passed away and negotiated many of the contracts that were left pending. So that's what he did.
Okay.
And we, I'm trying to remember, anyway, that's how it all worked out that we settled here. Oh, getting back to my job at the Fresno County Library. When I first started working we moved here the end of 94. In 95, I came to the Kingsburg Library to volunteer, and I was shelving books, and, you know, my children were in school, and I've always enjoyed, I worked in the library shelving books and helping out when I was in high school. So I always loved the library. There was an opening for a library assistant in Parlier, which is a small farm worker community 6 miles from here, from Kingsburg. And I applied. I took the county job, the exam, and everything. Like, you know, I have been tested to death. So I applied, and I scored very high, and I was shocked. I go, oh, my gosh, okay, this is nice. So then I was interviewed, and I was given the job. What I did not know is that as a senior library assistant for Parlier, I was the only one in the library. So it was like my little home. And I was really happy because it's a farm worker community. So as farm workers would come in, they would just go and look at the little novelitas, which are like the little comic, they're the little graphic novels. And so I encouraged them to get library cards. And then when new books would come in, I would say, look, this has come in. And I encouraged them to bring their children and their families and just started having that rapport with everybody that came in. But many of them were farm workers that had never applied for a library card. And so I had a wonderful supervisor who is now the associate library for Fresno County. And she encouraged me to do a lot of things, and she helped me so much, really, to to bring a lot of changes to that branch. And it was very nice, very, very rewarding. We had a lot of family events, and we got new computers that were donated by Gates, and family started coming in, and we started teaching them how to use computers, and just how to kind of, you know, just our philosophy in the Farm Workers Union is, you know, and it's a philosophy I learned from Caesar, that everybody is important. We need to value everyone, adults, children, everyone, and that, you know, just guide them, you know, show them, and then they teach them, but everyone is able to teach themselves afterward. And that was my philosophy. Look, here we have, I would stand literally behind the counter because I was the only one there, and people would come in, and I would give them directions from where I was standing. Now do this, now do, after showing them how to use the mouse and how to scroll and how to do all this stuff, I would just stand back and I would say, okay, now click here, now click there, just from far away. And they were like all excited, and pretty soon they were like so proficient using a computer, and they would come, farm workers would come in and check their email, and they would communicate with the loved ones in Mexico, and they had a whole other thing over there in Mexico where they have places where you can go to use, at that time, you know, where you could go, you know, use their computers. I believe now they're many of them have them in their homes. But that was really nice.
Mm-hmm.
Then I worked with, the librarians have always been very kind to me. they worked with me, they asked me for help and advice, or I would seek them out. And one particular person brought in a lot of, he was hired to bring in a lot of literature, new materials in Spanish, really nice, you know, just a variety of materials, health, automotive materials, art, you know, all that. And so as people would come in, I would tell them, look, we have all this new stuff. And then as people came in and would want to check out books and we didn't have them and I would order them from other libraries, I started ordering things that they were requesting so that we could have them at our library. Then in, I guess it was like in 2000, I applied. A new position came up. We started our literacy program. Again, we had had it in the past, but we didn't have funding. So we had passed Measure B in Fresno County, which was a quarter of a penny from your sales taxes. And I applied for the job, and I was hired to be the Families for Literacy Coordinator. So I had seen in Parlier where families would come in and they would tell their children, okay, there are the books, go get them. And then the kids would come, and then the parents really didn't know how to look for the books or how to even read to their children. And I would talk to them, and they said, well, no, I don't know how to read. And they thought that they were hurting their children if they sat and looked at a book with them. And I saw that there was a real need to work with families that could not read. Because then I had a whole other group that would come in and wanted to check out these materials where they would learn English, you know, tapes and recordings and that sort of thing. So I saw that there was a big need in the community. So when the position opened up, I decided to go there so that I could help families. So our adult learners that have children 5 and under right now, I work with them to help them get their children ready for kindergarten. I teach the parents reading strategies, to use at home with their children to help them love books, understand books, to read books, and handle books, and just all the language, the vocabulary, the letter recognition, all that phonemic awareness, so that when children begin school, they're not behind. They're already ahead. They feel comfortable with language and with books. I don't get to work with the children, only the parents, but every 3 months, I meet with the entire family, and we throw a little celebration party. So it's very nice. But, you know, I know for a fact that a lot of the things that I do And a lot of the things that I believe in have to do so much with the philosophy that Cesar Chavez taught us. For a long, long time, I didn't understand. I understood the feeling, but I didn't know the word. Like, I understood when somebody was talking down to me. I learned later that they were being condescending. I knew that people were being, like, straight out nasty, you know, dirty Mexican, go back to Mexico. I didn't know. Took me a while. That's racism. I knew that, okay, all you Mexicans are a bunch of lazies. Lazy greasers, you're lazy, you don't want to work. How could that be? Here we work so hard. We're not lazy. I mean, we are very creative. And not only creative in that we do take care of ourselves, we're not lazy, but we're very inventive. How many ways can you cook hamburger meat? Let me tell you. We would not go hungry. And I thought that's a stereotype. Also, that's what that word is that they've been using. I mean, that's the word connected to the feeling. And they were deceitful. I mean, skimming off of our work. We would pick boxes and boxes. At the end, you know, we get paid, and some of those boxes are missing. We're not getting paid for them. Some of our work is missing. You know, my dad and my brother had a car. They would drive to the grower, and he would make them park the car. And then they had to get in the company bus to go to the field to work. And then they would get $9 a day, and they would charge them $2 for the bus ride. And they had their own car. That is really deceitful. That is wrong. Mm-hmm. I learned deceitful. You know, my brother was working for Pegarulo with his buddies. One of his buddies, his mom was a widow, but I don't know if she was a widow, but she was a single parent. They lived in a little garage, cooking in a little tiny, a little coal in the wall garage, cooking in a little kerosene stove. And he was the only one that could help his mom and support her. They're out swamping. His name is Martin. They're my brother and another guy named Mingo, another one of his friends. And while they're swamping, he accidentally bumped into some of the boxes. Martin bumped into some of the boxes and knocked them down. And Pegarulo was angry. And he came and he fired them. He fired him. Just Martin. And so my brother felt so bad. He goes, no, you know what? It was an accident. He goes, oh, no, get out of here, get out of here. And he goes, no, don't do that, you know. You know, we need to work, but no, get out of here. So then my brother said, look, we're leaving. What? We're leaving. Heck with this. That was just not fair, you know, what he was doing to Martin. It could have been any of them. So then the Pegarulo said, no, they had already worked 6 whole hours. You know, and there was like still like about 2,000, 3,000 lugs of grapes out in the fields. And he goes, you know what, we're leaving. You fired him, we quit. Because they tried to reason with him, and he wouldn't take them back. So they all quit. He goes, oh, you can't do that. Wait a minute, stay. He goes, are you going to hire him back? No. Okay, we're leaving. So they left. They never got paid for those 6 hours lugging grapes. Mm-hmm. You know, that would have been a lot of money for them. Right. And so you know what, that's being really wrong. So I learned a lot of words that I didn't know before, and it took me a while to figure it out. Just one thought too, that I always found kind of strange, that they would say Mexicans, oh, you're out there wanting to get welfare. Well, what are we going to do? There's no work during the winter. You know, it's not like we were not working. You know, there's those times when there is no work. There was no unemployment during that time. The union fought for unemployment. Dolores Huerta went up to Sacramento and worked her little tail to get unemployment for all farm workers. You know, the United Farm Workers was very instrumental in that. But we didn't have unemployment in our day. So, no unemployment. We had no... some of us had to go on welfare. There was no unemployment. yet we were looked down for that. They looked down on us for that. But yet, if the grower, the grower was given money by the government not to grow crops, they were given subsidies. If I don't know, that sounds a little bit like welfare to me.
Listen, Abby, our time is up, and
okay.
I just want to thank you ever so much for this interview about you and your family and your brothers and sisters and the influence of Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers on your entire generation. So
truly,
thank you.
The biggest influence of my life. And you know, Cesar always said that our bodies are the only things that we have. You know, he hit it right on the mark. You know, our dignity, you know, that's what we have. And
right.
Nobody can take that away from us. And I think that that's what really, really made me just love the man, because he sacrificed a lot for us. You know, he believed in what he was doing. He knew what he was doing. He had to help us open our eyes, because we just saw a lot of bits and pieces that we had never connected it. He's the one that, and even my brother says, you know what, before Cesar Chavez, we didn't even know who these growers were. We didn't even know their names. We didn't even know how rich they were. You know, not that, you know, that all of them were bad. I don't know. You know, I like to be real decent about it. But you know what? Fair is fair. Even a little child knows when you're being unfair.
Right.
And
okay, Abby,
so
I just...
There it is.
I,
our bodies and our spirits,
okay.
And the justice of our cause is our weapon.
All right. Thank you very much, Abby Flores Rivera. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Goodbye.